wonder which is characteristic of childhood is a wondrous thing. There are, of course, no good witches of the north, no tooth fairies. The teddy bear, the doll, really can't enter a conversation with you. But the adult who tries to disabuse the three-year-old or the four-year-old of this kind of wonder does that child no favor. For the child is, through his imagination, projecting on the universe a warmth, a sense of the miracle, a sense of the possibility of life. He's arguing against that proposition, arguing in an emotional sense against the proposition that the world is a truly cold, closed, callous place. There's something comfortable, warming, responsive about the universe. And as we grow older, that sense of wonder matures into a very positive feeling about life. The person who's disabused early, who's talked to only about realistic things, becomes a cynic, becomes convinced that there's no real possibility to life, therefore grows very much within himself. But most of us, because we were allowed our imagination, allowed the good fairies and the good witches and the teddy bears that talked, most of us continue to believe, despite all the evidence, that the world is a comfortable place, that we can make our place in the world, that when the buffeting gets rather brutal, there will still come a time when all things will turn out for the good. Now, a rabbi's child, unfortunately, gets disabused about some of these wonder stories rather early on. When I was 4 or 5, I found the main sanctuary to be a miraculous place. It had that wonderful size to it, the shadows in the corner and way up there on the dome. And most wonderful of all was that light that burns in that grand eternal light in front of the ark. Burned forever. It was an eternal light. And every time I entered the sanctuary, that light was glistening through the little red vessel which contained it. And I was old enough to know that if I lit a candle, the candle would diminish until it ultimately went out. But every time I went into the temple, there the light was, eternally burning, a miracle. Until one day I came in to my mother to pick up my father, and I wandered into the temple, and there was the janitor on a stepladder with another candle in his hand, one of those vessels, about to put in the new light for the old one which had gone out. And something of the wonder of life disappeared. Some years later, when I was at college, I went to a service in Boston, which was a dedication of a sanctuary. One of the temples was making one of the very early moves from the center city to the suburbs. And as part of this change of location, very moving part of the service, some of the lifelong older members of the temple brought ceremoniously into their new sanctuary a candle which had been lit from the light of the sanctuary in which they would no longer worship, and from that light they lit the Ner Tamid, the eternal light, in the new sanctuary. And the eternal light regained some of its wonder. It represented to me the 3,000 and more years of the continuity of our religious quest and of our religious service and of our people. And I must confess, however, that newfound sense of wonder has been sorely tried by technology. Once architects began to design eternal lights where there was no longer a candle but a General Electric electric light bulb, I lost some of that sense of continuity because you can't light a new bulb from a used bulb, a bulb that's gone out. But by the time that this heresy in quotation marks had taken place, I was well enough along to know that technology had in fact over time often changed the nature of the eternal light. That the original Ner Tamid had not been a candle at all, but an oil light, a vessel holding liquefied oil with a wick put into it, and that the technology of the third or fourth century must have led the rabbis of the time, the children rabbis of the time, to question the eternality of the light just as I had. In any case, the story of the Ner Tamid, of this electric light bulb. The story of the light is the one I'd like to tell you this morning, and it is a fascinating story with many twists and turns. If you're a collector of eternal lights, I don't think anybody here is, or I would have heard about it, but if you do collect them, you'll find that a number of the lights which hung in synagogues in the Middle Ages had about them an inscription. The inscription came from the book of Leviticus, from the 24th chapter of Leviticus. Lakachta alecha shemen zayit zach katit lamaor la'alot ner tamid. You shall take for yourself pure olive oil beaten for the light in order to light the ner tamid, the eternal light. Or at least that's the translation which this inscription assumes. However, when you read the sentence in context, and the context is that of a series of instructions given by Moses to the greatest craftsman of his time, Bezalel, in which he tells Bezalel exactly how he is to make all of the vessels which are to go into the Mishkan, the wilderness tabernacle. And he instructs him on the basis of blueprints, essentially given to him by God. When you read the text in context, it's clear that it does not tell us that in ancient Israel there was a single eternal light the way we have it, but simply that the Israelites were to take a pure olive oil beaten for the light, mollified oil, and they were to use this oil to light lights which would burn regularly in the shrine. Now we do know something about the shape of the lampstand on which these lights burnt. In fact, we know quite a bit about them, and that's interesting because it's clear that the shape of the lamp itself was crucial to the understanding of the symbol. In other words, that the light that was demanded was not simply a light to illumine a dark space, although the wilderness tabernacle had no windows, and it obviously would have been an entirely dark area had there been no lights lit within it. What did these lights look like? Well, some of you have seen pictures, at least, of the last of the great candelabra, which burned in the shrine in Jerusalem, the temple in Jerusalem. Because if you've been in Rome, you've gone to the Forum, you've seen there the great triumphal arch of the Emperor Titus, who destroyed Jerusalem in the year 70, you'll see on a panel, stone panel, on the inside of the arch, a relief of the triumphal procession of the legions when they come back to Rome, and there are two legionnaires carrying aloft a great menorah, a great seven-branched candlestick as the symbol of the destruction of the temple. Why of all the objects from the booty taken from the temple is this candelabra, this menorah, carried aloft? Well, the historian of the time, Josephus, tells us that this golden candelabra, the most glorious of all the menorot ever put in the temple, put there just a few decades before by Herod, weighed about a talent of pure gold. Now, a talent is nearly 100 pounds. 100 pounds of pure gold, by my calculations, would be worth today about $500,000. $500,000 of gold in those days, where there was not the kinds of money that there are today, was an enormous sum. And what the Romans were doing were not celebrating an object which was sacred to the Jews, but celebrating the wealth of the booty which had been brought back to the temple in Jerusalem, to the temple of peace, which is where all of this booty was ultimately displayed. Now, if you remember the image of the menorah, it's a seven-branch candelabra, but rather squat. It has a heavy base, and it's about as broad as it is tall. We have, fortunately, a slightly earlier picture of the menorah, which was drawn or incised into a mortar wall in a hostel in Jerusalem by a pilgrim who went to Jerusalem to pay his homage at the temple, 50 years before the destruction of the temple, and who obviously had an artist's eye and a ready hand, and who, I'm sure to the chagrin of the hotel keeper where he hired lodgings, he took some kind of instrument and he drew onto the wall of his room, incised into the wall, an image of the menorah, which is rather higher than the image of the menorah, which is on the Arch of Titus, and not quite as broad. But in terms of the seven branches, in terms of the central staff, in terms of a rather solid base, in terms of the flowerets, the rosettes, which are on the branches and central stem, very much similar in shape. And this image of the menorah is actually a rather careful reproduction of the instructions of God to Bezalel through Moses, which we find stated twice in Scripture, twice in the Torah, and at great length. And let me read to you the description of Bezalel's instructions. Moses says, Bezalel shall make the lampstand of pure gold. He made the lampstand, its base and its shaft of hammered work. Its cup, calyxes, and petals were of one piece with it. Six branches issued from its sides, three branches from one side of the lampstand, and three branches from the other side of the lampstand. There were three cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with calyxes and petals on the one branch, and there were three cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with calyx and petals on the next branch. So for all six branches issuing from the lampstand. On the lampstand itself, there were four cups shaped like almond blossoms, each with calyxes and petals, a calyx of one piece with it under a pair of branches, and a calyx of one piece with it under the second pair of branches, and a calyx of one piece with it under the last pair of branches. So for all six branches issuing from it. Their calyxes and their stems were of one piece with it, the whole of a single hammered piece of gold. He made its seven lamps, its tongs, and its fire pans of pure gold. He made it and all its furnishings out of a talent of pure gold. Now, that's an extended description. Extended because writing was not easy in ancient times, because parchment was very expensive. To have gone to this detail in terms of the making of the menorah indicates the importance ascribed by our ancient forefathers to its shape. Now, this description, though it appears in the Torah as if Moses had the lampstand made in his day, is believed by scholars to be a bit of historical retrojection, that is, a description by later people who had seen how the shrine was established in Jerusalem rather than what the desert tabernacle is really like. But clearly, the menorah, the seven-branched candelabra, with the central stem, three sets of branches coming up, seven lights, an even level at the top, is the oldest symbol in continuous use among our people. And so the question is, what does it represent? What did they believe that this menorah stood for, if it was not simply a lamp to light the sanctuary? And by way of answer, and we can now come to a far better answer than our forefathers could, because of the way in which archaeologists and scientists and linguists have been able to decipher the cuneiform tablets and the wall paintings of the ancient world, we now know that one of the most popular of ancient myths, known in Mesopotamia and in Egypt, known as early as the Sumerian city culture of the third millennium before the Common Era, was a myth about a great tree of life which grew in paradise, which provided nourishment for the gods, and whose fruit not only nourished the gods, that is, provided them their ambrosia and their nectar, but provided them that vital essence which guaranteed their immortality. This is the tree of life, of immortal life. And there are all kinds of myths from the ancient world about attempts by mortals to break through, to take from this tree of life, to become immortal in their turn. In Greek mythology, we have, for instance, the story of Hercules, who was one of his labors when he was in Africa, is supposed to have sought after the golden apples of the Hesperides. And the golden apples grew on a tree which is guarded by a dragon. And Hercules, with his great club, was able to beat the dragon to death and take from the golden apples. And according to the myths, this made him a semi-immortal, gave him immortality. Now, obviously, the story that I'm telling you reminds you, or at least it should, of the story of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. What was the tree that grew in the center of the Garden of Eden? It's called in the Bible the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It's also called the tree of life. And what happens to Adam and Eve when they violate the only law, rule, which is given them for life in the Garden of Eden? You are not to eat of the fruit of the tree of life. They are punished. They are driven out into the real world. They are mortal. Their lives now have all of the contingency to them with which we're all familiar. Now, if you go back into Mesopotamian mythology, and you look at the seals of people in the ancient world, you look at their ark, you'll find any number of representations of this tree. Sometimes it has 7 branches, sometimes it has 9 branches, but this is the tree of life. And you'll find also stories which say that some of the gods and goddesses live in this tree of life, particularly the goddess of fertility, Sibyl, Astarte. She has many number of names. So what we have in the symbol of the tree of life, of the great golden menorah, is a symbol of immortality, of the immortality of the gods, of the presence of the gods and the power of the gods. And this explains, interestingly, why one of the customs of the Canaanites, whom our Israelite fathers dispossessed when they entered the Holy Land, was to have at their inside the compound of their shrines an Asherah, a sacred tree. The tree, the Asherah, was symbol of the presence here of the God. The menorah in the shrine in Jerusalem was a symbol, in the first instance, of the presence here of the God. And that, of course, was the sense which comes from Beit El, which is the house of God. But our ancestors knew this symbol more than simply a sign of the presence of God. The Bible gives very specific directions about the placement of the menorah. The shrine, the central enclosed shrine, was a rectangular room divided in half by a curtain. In the front half were the various utensils used in worship, the menorah, the altar for libations, the altar for incense, a place for the 12 loaves of the showbread, one loaf for each of the 12 tribes. And behind the parochet, behind the veil, was the Holy of Holies, the room which in Second Temple times was empty, in First Temple times presumably had the ark, which contained the tablets of the law, which represented the presence of God himself. And we're told that the menorah was to be placed directly in front of the veil. But we're told something else. We're told that the 7 lamps which are on top of this lampstand are to be put in such a way that the wick, the opening, faces not the people, not the priests, but the veil itself. Now, when one looks at the architecture and the monuments of the ancient world, one discovers something very interesting. The 9-branch tree of life is often depicted. But there are no depictions outside of what we know of the menorah, of a lampstand, of a tree of this kind, which is used as a lampstand. Question then is, what did these lamps represent? And the answer, we believe, is this. The most common object worshipped in the ancient world was the sun. The sun was a source of light. It brought the heat which allowed the crops to grow. It brought the heat which allowed human beings to survive. It brought light into the darkness of the world. Now, in Mesopotamian astronomy, there were seven objects in the heavens which were believed to create light: the sun, the moon, and the five known planets. The ancients who worshipped the sun worshipped a great fire. They worshipped the sun disk. They worshipped light. Israel worshipped the creator of all life and of all light. Now, the seven lamps clearly represent the seven sources of light as known to the ancient world: the sun, the moon, the five planets. But they're to be placed by its prescription in the Torah so that the light is cast not outward towards the people so it may be reverenced, but towards God himself, towards the presence of God behind that veil, as if to acknowledge, by the way the light flickers towards the source of all light, that they are subsidiary, secondary. It is God and God alone who is the creator of all. Now, the Bible often speaks of God in terms of light or fire. God is a consuming fire. He is a source of all life and of all light. And so our fathers had, in the way this symbol was organized, a way of affirming that God is the creator. God is not only in this place, but the God who is here is the creator of all that this place represents. And then there's another level to this symbol. There was another level to this symbol in the eyes of our fathers. It represented a model of all that is. The pedestal was the foundations of the earth, of the world, the cosmos. The great spine of the menorah was that axis which held up the world. The branches which come out represent all that is, all that we know in the visible world. And the lights represent the heavens above, reaching out, casting their light towards the creator of all. And all kinds of cosmological and metaphysical speculations were derived from the very nature, the very design of the menorah itself. Now, as our fathers became more and more familiar with this great seven-branch candelabra, and as the traditions of our people began more and more to speak in terms of immortality, of the hope for life beyond the grave, which is a hope which grew particularly during Second Temple times, we find more and more on grave sites of Jews the symbol of the menorah. It symbolized the possibility of immortality. If you go down into the Jewish catacombs in Rome, and you look at the symbols which are there, the menorah is the primary one. It exists in gold glass medallions which are placed into the wall above the crypt where the ossuaries were kept. It is incised into the stone over and over again. And almost to modern times, particularly in the Sephardic world, you'll find that the gravestone will have incised or on it in one way or another the menorah, the symbol of immortality. But in the Jewish tradition of our people, the menorah came to have a slightly different emphasis. Remember, the menorah is the greatest, certainly the most costly of all the vessels, which was in the temple in Jerusalem. And so, after the destruction of the temple in the year 70, the menorah came to represent the temple itself in iconography, and the certainty, the assurance, the faith that in time the temple would be rebuilt, that the national hope of the Jewish people was an immortal one. And so if you look at the mosaics which were designed in the floors of synagogues in Israel and the diaspora in the 3rd, 4th, 5th centuries, generally they focus on a shrine, which is really an ark, but the front of the ark has doors which look like the doors of the temple, and usually the ark has on each side a pillar, which represents the two pillars which were at the entrance to the temple in Jerusalem. And then they're flanked with one or two great menorahs, symbol of the promise that the temple itself is immortal, that it will come again into being, that is God's certain promise to Israel. And if you look at what has been uncovered of the synagogues of ancient Israel, you'll find that the menorah was never rebuilt. They made no attempt to put a model menorah inside the shrine. But on the lintel of the synagogue, you will often find, that is, on the stone across the door, the main entrance in the synagogue, you'll often find inscribed a menorah, symbol that this is the Mikdash Mat, a small sanctuary, but the real sanctuary will come when, in time, when God will rebuild it. And I put here on the altar such a symbol. This is a replica of a menorah which was found on the lintel of a synagogue in the Galilee near Tiberias. It's, if you examine it closely, as I hope you will after services, you'll notice that the flowerets, the little flowers, are very visible on the stems. It doesn't have its stem or its base. This is the way it was found. And it has a place at the top for the seven lights, although they were never lit. This was simply a symbol that here is, in the synagogue is a surrogate, a temporary structure in which Israel worships until that great moment when the temple will come again into being and Israel will have its natural relationship with God. And so, interestingly, the seven-branch menorah, though it had been the central, most costly, most visible, best-known symbol in the temple in Jerusalem, was never reintroduced as a specific object, as a vessel, into the synagogue. And to this day, you will almost never see as a seven-branched candelabra, the menorah, on a pulpit in a modern synagogue. It is not an object of the synagogue. It is a symbolic object representing the temple, the messianic promise, and the hope of our people. Now what happened, and this is an interesting story by itself, what happened to the golden menorah, this very, very expensive menorah which Herod had built and which the Romans gonifed? They brought it to Rome. They set it up in the Temple of Peace, which was part a temple in the Forum and part a museum. And it was visible there. You could go and view it for many decades. There's a legend which is very popular in Christian circles, that this golden menorah remained visible in the Temple of Peace until the year 453 of this era, when the Vandals came down in one of their attacks and sacked Rome and took the golden menorah along with other wealthy, costly vessels of the Romans with them to Carthage, where they built their own empire. And then, according to this Christian legend, in the year 533, the Byzantine emperor, General Belisarius, conquered Carthage, and he found this great costly golden menorah there, and he shipped it back to Constantinople. And there, two stories are told. They're inconsistent, but both of them appear in Christian legend and lore. One is that his emperor, Justinian I, was so overcome by having the symbol of the temple, of the people who had been superseded by the Christians, and immediately sent it back to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, where it was set up as proof that we are now, that is, we the Christians are now the chosen people. This is now the temple in Jerusalem. And it remained during the rest of the 6th century in Jerusalem until early in the 7th century, the Persians conquered Jerusalem and then carted the golden menorah off on another journey east where it disappears from history. The other Christian story is that the golden menorah remained in Constantinople for hundreds of years until 1096, when during the Fourth Crusade, these holy crusaders sacked the Byzantine Christian capital, carried off everything they could, burnt the golden vessels down for loot, and that marked the end of the golden menorah. If you want to read a wonderful description of all these legends, Stefan Zweig wrote a book some years ago called The Golden Menorah, which I commend to you if you like legend. There's no history in it, but it's a wonderful story of what might have been. Now, unfortunately, our Jewish sources do not confirm these Christian legends. The Tosefta, which is a set of laws which were like the Mishnah, which were drawn up late in the 3rd century, tell of a Galilean rabbi by the name of Eliezer ben Yossi, who went to visit the emperor towards the end of the 2nd century on a particular mission from the Jewish patriarch. And while he was in Rome, he did what any of us would do. He went to the Temple of Peace to see what could be seen of the holy objects which were once in the temple. And he saw there the veil which had been in front of the face of the high priest. He saw there a number of other holy vessels, but not the golden menorah. Why not? Well, those who know Roman history tell us that just before 190 of this era, the Temple of Peace had a fire, and that it lost a lot of its objects, as if the, God forbid, one of the great museums of the world were on fire and some of the great pieces there were destroyed. And apparently, the logic would lead us to believe that the golden menorah was damaged in some way during this fire, and somebody decided to melt it down. There was a lot of gold. It wasn't worth much as a smudged object, and that marked the end of the menorah. But not quite. The menorah was to have, as all great symbols do, an afterlife. It remained alive in the Jewish tradition as a symbol on graves of the promise of immortality. It remained in the synagogue, or in front of the synagogue, a symbol of the promise of national redemption. It remained in the Christian church, a symbol of immortality and of resurrection. Any number of churches in Europe had before their altar a seven-branched candlestick. When I first saw some of these candlesticks, which were made popular particularly after Charlemagne established one at his great royal chapel in Aachen, I thought these were all candelabra which had been gone up from synagogues all over Europe and just put up because they were beautiful objects. But the synagogue didn't have the menorah. So this is one thing the church didn't gone up. What they did was to look upon themselves as the legitimate heirs of the priestly temple tradition. And here was a symbol of the temple. Their altar was now the temple altar. Their priests were now the legitimate heirs of the temple priest. The menorah was now a symbol of that legitimacy, and it also stood for resurrection, the great promise, which was central to their religious tradition. So all during the Middle Ages, you'll find seven-branch candlesticks, menorot, in front of some of the greatest altars of the churches and cathedrals of the Christian world. The Jews, however, were faced with a problem. We're told in Scripture there are to be lights in our sanctuaries. But now the menorah is a symbol of the sanctuary which will be rebuilt. The synagogue has replaced the menorah. How is light to be associated with the synagogue itself? And the answer became the Ner Tamid as we know it, the eternal light. Originally, the eternal light seems simply to have been a light, a special light, placed in the synagogue, not next to the ark, but on the wall that faced Jerusalem as a mizrach, as a symbol of the direction in which worship was to take place. The juxtaposition of the ark with the eternal light above it is relatively modern. It requires a room such as this, which is lit by electric light where you don't need a lot of illumination. But most of the ancient synagogues were like the mosques of the Islamic world. They required inner illumination, and you had those great mosque lights that come down all over to give illumination to the room. So the synagogues of the Islamic world, of the early medieval world, were filled with various kinds of lights, often memorial lights, which were given to in honor of the memory of someone who had died, which provided illumination for the worshippers. And it was very hard to differentiate which was the eternal light from all the other lights. But gradually, the sense that there was a light which pointed towards Jerusalem and an architectural change in the nature of the synagogue which began to put the ark itself on the wall which faced Jerusalem led over time to this identification of a single light and of the ark. The kind of identification we have here in the main sanctuary and almost all the synagogues of the modern world. And out of that change comes the Ner Tamid as we know it. Now the menorah itself was to have another resurrection. In 1948, when the State of Israel was established, those who established the state chose as the shield of the new state a shield in the center of which was an outline of the menorah as it appears on the Ark of Titus. On the two sides were branches rising. Interesting how the old tree of life symbolism was somehow picked up by a what was then a secular socialist state. And then below it, the word Yisrael, Israel. And to this day, this remains the symbol. And it was an appropriate symbol because the sense of the immortality of the Jewish people, reaching back from the beginning to now, was captured in this symbol itself. And what of the single light, the eternal light of the synagogue? It remains what most of us feel it to be, a symbol of a place where worship, our worship, is sacred, a symbol of the presence of God in that place, made God's presence being there because of our concerns and our hopes. There's a midrash with which I conclude. Moses is commanded by God, according to this legend, to build the great lampstand. And he's puzzled. He said, God, you're the source of light. Why must we create a vessel to give you light? And God answers, that's your whole purpose and being. As I give light, you must give light. Enlightenment, the light of hope, the light of service to mankind. And it's that which the Ner Tamid represents to us and to Jews everywhere. Amen. Thank you.